Have you ever seen an ad in the middle of streaming that was so engaging and so captivating that you had to learn more about that product and actually pause the video you were watching to exit out and do additional research? A majority of consumers say they've done that in the last week. That's the future of advertising that we're seeing come about.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Today, we're excited to have Dallas Lawrence. He's the Chief Communications and Brand Officer for OpenX, the programmatic advertising company. Prior to joining OpenX, Dallas served as the Chief Communications Officer for Rubicon Project, led global communications and government affairs for Mattel, and served as the Chief Global Digital Strategist for Burson Marsteller. So it's safe to say he knows a thing or two about a thing or two. Today, we're going to be covering a wide array of topics with Dallas, most notably the advertising trends of tomorrow, today's consumer shopping trends, and what those trends can tell us about the future of commerce. So, Dallas, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So, for those of our listeners who aren't so familiar with your work, what can you tell them about programmatic and about what the company does in general?
I think the easiest way to think about OpenX and the programmatic marketplace is it's the exchange that enables the open web to thrive. All that great content that we love to get for free has to be monetized with advertising. And there's an exchange that sits in between that, like a NASDAQ, where a buyer can come in, a brand, and buy that consumer attention. And we're the technology that sits in between that. So we represent 20,000 brands, marketers, and agencies who want to reach hundreds of millions of consumers. And we're the technology layer that sits in between that.
I think one of the reasons that I really wanted to talk to you is because the diverse set of experiences that you've had, you know, it seems like by intent, you're not really doing consistently the same thing, you know, for...
That's boring.
It definitely is. And I think that that honestly gives you a better view of the future when you're able to look at a problem from a number of different directions. So I kind of recapped a little bit of your conversation, but what attracted you to the programmatic advertising world?
You know, it's the environment is constantly in flux right now. We've never seen a time of change at this speed that we're seeing today, where we're seeing entire new mediums pop up within a matter of 8, 12, 24 months that were not even existing before. The speed at which that's happening is exciting. If you love technology, if you love innovation, if you like thinking about what's going to come next around the corner, programmatic technology, advertising technology sits right at the kind of the corner of all of that technology and change that's happening in a $700 billion marketplace. So we have the big players of Google and Facebook who operate, but you also have a lot of innovation happening just below the layer of that that is shaping that almost now trillion-dollar market.
Yeah, and I think that, you touched upon so much. There's so much money in this market, but it's also becoming so much more of a fragmented market than ever before, which I find really interesting to follow. When you're talking about the media industry today, you know, for those, to kind of almost give a bit of an explainer, how has it become so fragmented? And what do you think that that actually means for the advertiser of tomorrow who's trying to make sense of this media landscape?
Yeah, consumers are spending exponentially more time now connected. So we know, for example, they spend about 6.5 hours every day on their phone doing something. And that's part of the fragmentation.
Can you say that again? I got a text.
Are you a millennial? Because it'd be 7.5 hours a day if you were a millennial.
I'm not a millennial. I think you can see the white hair on my the stubble that I have. But a lot of people have said that I'm as irreverent as a millennial, so thank you.
You're welcome. So what we see in this marketplace is that just that level of fragmentation is not just they're on their device, they're on multiple devices, but what they're doing on that device. It used to be a lot easier to reach consumers. They were on, if you want to go back 40 years, they were watching 3 television channels, and it became a few more with cable. And there was a few dominant platforms online you'd go to. But now we have folks, if you look at the average consumer today, they're spending about 2.5 hours every day streaming content on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon. They're watching podcasts, listening to podcasts. We have a third of consumers listen to podcasts every week, over an hour, a week that's consuming that content. They're streaming music. They're on their social platforms. And that's becoming a much more complex ecosystem with which to engage them if you're a brand marketer. So that's when we talk about fragmentations. We're connected like we've never had been before, but we're doing it across really a multitude of devices, screens, and platforms.
No, I think that's very true. And I actually, there's no real great way to transition into this, but we'd like to ask people a number of different irreverent questions
Fire
to get
away.
To know the people we're talking to. So I think lightning round question number one, and you're not privy to any of these beforehand. So do you know Donald Rumsfeld? And if so, what is he like?
He is probably the best boss I ever had. And I did work for him for 3 years. I had the privilege to work for him. This is the way I describe Donald Rumsfeld. So he was a professional college wrestler, which is, one, good to note, not a team sport. And two, it's a sport where you ultimately are, you know, you defeat the opponent by breaking them into submission, right? So that's the mindset of a wrestler. And what I loved about Rumsfeld is there really are three Rumsfelds. There's the Rumsfeld who's before the wrestling match, is on intake, wants every bit of information from every avenue he can get it from. He was a sponge for information. There's the in-the-match Rumsfeld, who is completely serious and focused and wants all side chatter to stop. The decision's been made, and we're going to execute, and we're going to win. And there's the post-match Rumsfeld, who likes to slap the towel in the shower and have a great time and is hysterical and has a great sense of humor. The challenge about Secretary Rumsfeld is you never want to confuse which part of the match you're in when you're having those conversations with him. So very dedicated to the military. I've never seen a person who was more dedicated. You know, we saw 9/11. Somebody who, you know, while others were being evacuated from the building, he actually ran into the fire to help carry out wounded folks. He took his job very seriously. Also, you know, just brilliant one-liners. I mean, how he could come up with the known unknowns and the other things that he did were just a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, I thought he was so incredibly quotable, and obviously people give, you know, civil servants and people who give up a lot of their time and effort, you know, to do roles like that, it's often thankless. But hopefully years afterwards, people, you know, point to the positives.
I mean, so. I named my dog after him, so that probably counts for him something. He probably appreciates that.
Named Donald or
Rummy?
Rummy. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, because Donald, I feel like, is not named, not such a popular dog yep. name, I feel like, these days. What is something weird about you that people would never guess about you just by looking at you?
I don't know if it's weird, but I've driven the submarine before. I've had the ability to actually put my hands on the wheel of a nuclear-powered submarine with 23 nuclear missiles on board and send it diving under the ocean.
I was going to say I can parallel park in New York, but that's about it. I think that you win that one. How often do you get told that you look like Benedict Cumberbatch?
I've actually heard that before, which I thought was great until he became Khan, and that kind of ruined it for me. You know, I think he was not quite as good as Ricardo Montalban. I'm showing my stripes here as a Star Trek fan, but I have gotten that before.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was really sad when you disappeared in Infinity War. So you live in Santa Monica. So in what ways is New York better?
I live outside of Santa Monica in a town called Calabasas, which is, you know, California is great for the weather. I think that's the one way that California probably has New York beat. New York is just, there's a vibe about New York that I love. It's like almost medicine for me when I come off and come downtown and you get that boost of energy.
Yeah, I think that's...
You don't have Kardashians.
We don't have, but that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I'll leave that to you.
Okay, that's fair. Every now and then we get an errant Kardashian. So
they're everywhere.
Yeah, you try to turn away and it's a little bit too late. It's kind of like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So anyway, so going back to things that I think are a little bit more relevant to figuring out what how to connect with a consumer of tomorrow. Okay. You know, we're speaking at the tail end of Advertising Week New York, right, where you presented and spoke. And I'm wondering, what are some of the trends that you noticed that people were talking about this week and, you know, just presenting on, you know, trends that you think that the average person should be paying more attention to?
I think the biggest topic on everyone's mind was really the dominant role that two key players are playing in the advertising ecosystem today and really kind of why that's not good for the health of a thriving open web. So if you consider that Facebook and Google, for example, capture 2/3 of all advertising dollars spent online, but they only capture 1/3 of consumer time spent. So what that means is all these amazing sites like the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, and your favorite sports blog, and everything else that's creating all this incredible content, these podcasts that are rich and deep with research and reporting, are not
Thank
getting,
you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Are not getting their fair share of advertising dollars. And that is a real concern. It's a concern for the open web. Folks who are out there trying to create this great content. And it's the marketer's single biggest concern when they're surveyed because they're forced to spend money in a place where people aren't. And they're doing that simply because it's just easier to do today. So that was really a hot button topic for everybody. How do you unlock that spend? on the open web? How do you make the open web feel and interact for a brand marketer the way Facebook does today with that ease and efficiency? The other topics I think were really hot top of mind for folks were the privacy issues right now. We're seeing just a patchwork of regulation come up that will be unsustainable right now. California has a law coming online in a couple months. We have 40 other states looking at different versions of privacy regulations, which means, you know, every time you cross the state line, you're going to be having to re-click the button that says, yes, I gave you permission, or no, I don't give you permission, which ultimately is going to make the whole privacy regimen kind of worthless at that point. So regulation was really top of mind for folks as well.
Yeah. And I think that you guys are also, and this is to me very, I tip my hat to you guys to try to help people understand a little bit what the consumer of tomorrow is going to be, you know, paying attention to. So I know that you guys recently released a holiday report talking about consumption habits going into, you know, Christmas 2019, holiday 2019, whatever you want to call it. What can you tell us about the findings? What were some of the things that stood out to you the most, or maybe were most surprising to you as you know, you conducted the study?
Yeah, so there were two huge, I think, top line trends, and we can unpack and dig into those if you like. The first one really is, you know, consumers are overwhelmingly actually optimistic about the future of the economy, which you wouldn't guess from reading the gloom and doom headlines about a recession coming. So 70% of consumers feel like the economy is going to improve in the next 12 months. And that optimism is actually going to fuel about a 5% overall increase in holiday spending. So really good news for retailers from a top-line perspective that consumers are optimistic. The other big macro shift we're seeing is how they are making those purchases. It is not, as you would imagine, just a brick-and-mortar game, and they're really diversifying how they're making that, how they're spending, when, where, and how they're making that those purchases.
Yeah, and I think that there, when I was taking a look at it, there were so many things that were really interesting to me about it. I think one of the top things was, I think it was, 53% of holiday spending is going to be happening digitally. And I think that that was, for the first time, maybe consumers were planning to do the majority of their holiday shopping online. Tell me if I'm wrong about that.
You nailed it. That's the game-changing headline of the report. I've been doing this research for 5 years, and this is the first time that consumers are saying that a majority of all dollars will be spent online. The real kicker is when you dig into like the crosstabs on demographics and you think, okay, maybe that's just millennials, Gen Z who are driving that. Nope, baby boomers are going to do 50% of their shopping online and digital this year. So big game-changing move for retailers, which is why we say, you know, it's going to be a good holiday season for retailers, but not for everybody. If you haven't developed a really engaged kind of 360 digital strategy, you know, we just saw last week Marshalls finally became an online retailer. By launching their online online portal about 20 years after the online revolution started. And we have a lot of other retailers that are still behind. So it's not going to be, it's kind of best of worlds and worst of worlds for some folks out there. There will be more spending, but it's going to go to digital. And what we're also seeing is that it's, you know, there isn't just a digital shopper. Digital is being accelerated by mobile. One out of every $5 this holiday season will be spent via a mobile device. So that really is a huge shift into how we're thinking about shopping. You look at some of the other demographics, the reason why we love to partner with Harris Poll, they're the research partner who did this, or the global researching firm, is you can dig deep and you can see things like, you know, high net worth earners are the least likely to walk into a store. So those who make over $100,000 a year are the least likely to do any retail shopping. They want to do most of their shopping online. You see major trends like Black Friday, which has always been a retail brick and mortar store. More consumers are saying this Black Friday, they're going to shop online for the Black Friday deals than actually go into the store. So we are seeing a really significant shift in how consumers are planning to spend a lot of money this holiday season.
Yeah, and I think that for me, one of the other things that kind of popped out about that was also in terms of not just what devices people are going to be shopping on, but where they're going to be doing the shopping, and the fact that, I mean, I think that well, let me finish my thought, is the idea that a lot of people are going to be shopping at work. 69% of people have made an online purchase at work, and 81% of millennials, right? So to me, I'll just kind of opine first. I think that what that means is...
Are you shopping right now?
I feel guilty that I'm not shopping right now, to be honest. Not that this isn't a fascinating conversation, but, you know, you get served so many ads that they're always in your head, and I'm like, Gap is 50% off this week, kind of like last week, but I should probably be shopping, right? And I think that probably because our work we're bringing it home more and more. So naturally, people feel that they have the ability or the wherewithal to do some of their shopping at the office. But I mean, I'm curious what you think about that, because that to me was a big takeaway, which is, you know, you're always capable of shopping. It's not just like get home and then you're allowed to.
That's right. I think that was absolutely one of the key takeaways, that consumers are really taking charge of when they're going to shop. There used to be that defined, you know, we would try to get you bombard the television ads at you during the primetime television hours. And that was the most coveted time to get you to try to hopefully have that pester power. And what you're seeing now is consumers are just as likely to shop between the hours of 5 a.m. and 8 a.m. as they are to shop between the hours of 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. So we have, you know, 15 or so percent on each side. They're doing the majority of their shopping during those windows. And you see this huge chunk that's shopping during the middle of the day. Part of what's driving that is smart retailers have made it incredibly easy to do mobile shopping. You're not spending 3 hours shopping through, you know, all these pictures. You are actually landing on a tailored ad that's desired for you. In your case, you want that 50% off on that polo shirt. You can point, click, and buy it and have it shipped to you in 24 hours in about a matter of 60 seconds. So that shift is really what's bringing about what we're seeing, this always on demand consumer who's shopping. And it's really changing how marketers think about their marketing time. The ability to not just have kind of awareness campaigns, but direct, we want you to buy right now. One out of three consumers this year said that advertising has driven them to make an impulse buy when done correctly.
Well, okay, and there's another follow-up there, which is not to say, I mean, I'm obviously a big believer in digital advertising. I think that, you know, word of mouth certainly is not dead. It's a matter of if somebody can refer you a brand, then they're always going to be, I mean, that counts for a lot, but it's not going to, like you said, have an impulse effect, you know, because you'll be like, I can always go ahead and talk to, you know, that brand and interact with them. But when I see a digital ad at the right place, I might pull the trigger on something and then it gets shipped to me. And then I say, what the heck, I'll keep it, you know, because inevitably that's the nice
thing.
You need
it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I need it now that I have it,
that's
and it's
right.
Hard to return, you know, or even if it's easy. You know, people, I think naturally, just especially Americans, just happen to enjoy the act of shopping and, you know, the thrill of the hunt to some extent.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what we are seeing this year is we're seeing a lot more interest to shop earlier. So, you know, we're in September. By September, majority of people had already started their holiday shopping, which is crazy to me. We haven't even picked out the Halloween costumes yet, but people are already shopping. So they are enjoying the process more, which is part of that the trend that we're seeing where they're taking back control. They're shopping how they want to, not just when they want. So retailers really aren't, they used to force you into a couple days, you know, you have to go on this day to get the best deal. And shoppers now know they can find the best deal on their terms.
Yeah, I actually just want to do all of my holiday shopping right after the holidays, get some great deals, put it all in storage, and then wait until I make a friend that might want the stuff that I just bought and then offload it to them that way.
You're talking about my grandmother, right? That's exactly how.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going to say also, I think another thing that was a takeaway to me when I'm looking at this is, and this is like that natural tension that you see, is the need to focus on these micro trends and things that are happening in a specific moment versus the macro, right? I mean, I think that there's always that danger, not to say that, you know, you're falling for that because you're always, you know, trying to look to see what are the macro trends that are happening in the market. I mean, nobody is expecting that, for instance, mobile shopping is going to go ad infinitum, continue to rise so that retail will 100% go away. But what are you expecting, even anecdotally, over the next few years based off of, you know, studying this data for a while?
I think we're seeing exponential shifts in consumer content behaviors that are then materializing in how they actually make purchases and do other things. So I'll give you one example. We regularly do research. So 6 months ago, we did our OTT study on streamers to get a sense for how are people streaming content? What is the growth of streaming? Is it mainstream today? Streaming, again, being Amazon, Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus when it comes online in a couple months. What we found in April was that 52% of U.S. adults stream. So we had a majority of adults are streaming. What we found last week when we released the data is that 70% of U.S. adults are now streaming. That is a massive shift in how consumers are engaging their time. And they're streaming a lot. They're spending 2.5 hours a day streaming content. When you unpack that, you look at millennials, you know, are more likely to stream than watch live television. And, you know, 42% of these people have either cut the cord or will. that shift in habits of how they're consuming content is also driving how advertisers or marketers are reaching them and how they're able to make purchases differently. I'll give you one data point that I loved from the research I thought was really cool, but just the impact of advertising when done correctly with the technology we have today. We asked those who were watching streamers, have you ever seen an ad in the middle of streaming that was so engaging and so captivating that you had to learn more about that product and actually paused the video you were watching to exit out and do additional research? And a majority of consumers say they've done that in the last week. Over 50% say they saw an ad, they captured them. That's the power of that connecting the mobile issue, because you're now watching this, we call it lean forward. You're leaning forward, watching this video program, your friend's episode on your mobile device. You have a great ad that's captivated you, and you know that in 60 seconds, you can click three times and have that product shipped to you. That's the future of advertising that we're seeing come about. So it will change, continue, will it be 100% mobile? No, but something's going to come next. We know, for example, 8% of all holiday purchases this year are going to initiate with an audio device in the house, an Amazon Alexa. Mm-hmm. That was like 1% last year. So something will come next, and then we'll continue this. The speed of innovation is really exciting in this space.
I mean, and yeah, as you talk about the fact that you can be interrupted by an ad just like you could 10, 15 years ago, and sometimes you'll actually go take some action off of it. I think that that's a really important stat. But I think it also touches upon the fact that this is forcing advertisers to deliver better ads, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the very fact that there are a finite number of ads that are out there, and then also the fact that there are a limited, yeah, just basically the fact, if you're on Netflix, you're not going to get served up an ad. And if you're on Hulu, then you will, but that ad has to, it better deliver, because if not, Hulu doesn't want it yeah. You know, as part of that platform.
It's interesting. So, you know, Hulu's a great example. So 7 out of every 10 subscribers choose the Hulu advertising model versus the subscription-based model. So they've chosen with their wallet saying, I actually want to save money and I'm willing to take a commercial. But you're absolutely right. They want it to be a relevant commercial. And the really exciting thing about TV is they're now taking the digital technology that we have that's able to deliver that relevant, personalized, yet privacy-compliant advertising that you see on your digital devices and mirror that for television. So we're not too far away from a world where the ad that you're seeing on your television streaming program is different than the one that your kids might be seeing on their mobile device watching the same program, or that your neighbor across the street is seeing, because they've delivered an advertisement that's tailored to you, that is delivering value to you.
And you touched on privacy, which I think is obviously something that's such a hot button issue. But I think another thing that people really care about now is targeting and relevancy, like you're talking about. Those two things, I feel like there is a natural tension between the two. And where do you think the answer, where are we going to net out as a society? I know that's a difficult thing to add. I mean, and I have a personal bias here, which is just that privacy is something that you want to hold on to if you're not getting value for it. And if you're giving it up and everybody else is giving it up and you're getting some, if you're getting something for it, then people will gladly trade it away. That's my bias. That's my gut feel, as opposed to I have data that I can show
I'll give you data now.
But yeah, please do.
You sit with the majority of Americans. So 68% of Americans say that they would be willing to trade some of their privacy for a more personalized ad experience, as long as it's done in a privacy-compliant way. And what that means is that I'm okay with you to use my data as long as you've anonymized it to deliver a more relevant advertising experience to me. I've been doing that exact question for 5 years, and that number has consistently been in the 2/3 or higher. Americans understand that to get all that amazing free content that we love, there's a value exchange. And that value exchange is you're going to deliver an ad to me. Now, where they get frustrated is when you give me a crappy ad. And the ad is useless, or that shoes that my wife purchased on her Amazon account are following me around for 3 months because you don't have the basic technology to actually figure out that I'm not the one who bought that or I already purchased it. So the technology has made it better for us to deliver that more relevant experience. Consumers, the word I like to use is permission. What consumers want is they want to make sure they've had the opportunity to give you permission. And once they've given you permission, then they want that value exchange to happen and they want it to be done in a privacy-compliant way.
Yeah. And I think that that's a really good way of putting it. There are a lot of people who are just kind of, they almost jump on the bandwagon where they start talking about privacy without necessarily knowing exactly the ins and outs of the consumer. And then something we were talking about a little bit before we even started recording today is the idea of the consumers of tomorrow. I had, my children specifically for, market research and consumer research. It's great to be able to see how they're going to look at these things. And I think that if they never had a view that they were deserved privacy in the first place, then, or that it was something that was inherent to their lives, they might not be as tied to privacy as an idea as you and I might be. So I don't know if that's anything that it should, certainly maybe not as much data, but just anecdotally.
Yeah, it's generational. Yeah. So we see the baby boomers, for example, the ones most concerned about their online privacy, and Gen Z are the least concerned, just in general when you ask them, because there is an expectation they understand, that Gen Z understands that there is very little expectation for what would be the traditional sense of privacy, what a baby boomer thinks about as privacy. So the social norms are changing, and those are actually impacting how we think about the entire business ecosystem we operate in.
Now, okay, I want to shift gears a little bit, right? Because I know you have a few accolades that I can... It's always nicer when somebody else reads the good things that you've done and won, right? Instead of you having to say them.
I'm not shy. I can read it too. So if you want me to... No, go ahead.
Yeah. for instance, okay, so PR News named you both the Crisis Manager of the Year and Social Media Professional of the Year. And PR Week named you one of the 40 most influential leaders in the industry. I put you in like 41 in my head, but that's okay. We'll give that to you. So I know staying humble is one of the keys to getting future predictions as accurate as possible, right? So, I mean, how does one stay humble when you've been recognized for your past accomplishments? And I'm not just talking about you, but anybody in general. How do you not let things go to your head when you're trying to, you know, better ascertain where things are going? And I think that running your own research with, you know, really accomplished partners is certainly part of that. But just anecdotally, for anybody who wants to be a better futurist, how do they tackle that topic?
Number one, have kids. They're the most humbling force on the planet. I don't think I'm even in the top 500 on their list. So, 41 is pretty good. I appreciate that. I think that, you know, that honestly does give you, at least for me anyways, a good sense of what matters and what doesn't. I've also, you know, been very blessed in my career to have phenomenal mentors who have helped you along the way and help you understand that your role is to give back. The things you've gotten are what you've been given, you need to give back out to others who come behind you. And in the communications and marketing field, it's a very tightly knit, peer mentoring organization where that is something that was just in the DNA of the field. So I've been very lucky to have those before me, and I'm trying to help those after me. But absolutely, kids are the great equalizer in that space. I think when we think about, why do we have a right to be thinking about what's coming next in the future? That's the reason why we partner with research folks. We actually want to know, we're not just guessing at the trajectory, we're actually asking consumers and then mapping it over years to get a sense for where are we moving to? What were the forces that pushed us in that direction? When do we reach a tipping point? Like I mentioned, we've reached with OTT now. 12 months ago, it was a niche thing. Marketers weren't spending advertising dollars on it. Only 5% of all TV advertising dollars today go to OTT and streaming, even though it's capturing 50% of consumer attention in many cases. So what we're leaning into is saying, look, there are huge market forces that are changing, and we need to make sure they impact the rest of the ecosystem equally.
How about the fact, and obviously you guys don't do this, but I have seen some people who don't work with strong research partners who they'll ask a question in a way, a leading question or something, just so that they can actually, and I took a look at your data, and I think the way that you put it together is, really strong. But there are certainly people out there who will say, they'll structure something so that there's no way that they're not going to get the answer that they want. And how does somebody just, what would you advise the marketers of tomorrow who are trying to structure things in the proper way so that they get the actual answer as opposed to just the answer that they want, which might then misinform their overall strategy?
Yeah, it's advice for marketers, but also for consumers at large as we head in this political election, because we're going to be bombarded with polling numbers. There are two types of polls in the industry. There's what they call a poll to show and a poll to know. The poll to show is where you ask the question to predetermine the outcome. The poll to know is you actually want to know what's on the consumer's mind. A poll to show would be an example of saying, if you knew that Senator X hated the environment, was opposed to, kids having education and was taking away free school lunches for those who are under economically disadvantaged, would you be less likely to vote for them? And the answer is yes. And the outcome comes out 58% less likely to vote about so-and-so. Those polls happen every single day.
I would think that would be higher than 58%
It depends on where. It can be 80%. But those happen every day. Those are the polls to show. We really like to get into the polls to know what we're asking consumers. Tell us about your habits. And, you know, you can get in the weeds on how polls are asked, but the order of which you ask questions matters, and the frequency in which you ask the same question. So, you know, for marketers, I worked at a company where we actually, a long time ago, they wanted research to show that their strategy was correct. And they got that research that showed their strategy was correct. 12 months later, the strategy was proven to be wrong, and the company ended up losing half its stock value. But that's, you know, you gotta want to go and be willing to let the research guide you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that that was the correct answer. No, I think that that's something that, unfortunately, a lot of people get wrong because there's so much pressure to basically, I mean, perfect example is when you see pundits on television, their goal is to say something as ostentatious and interesting as possible, and they never get called out on whether or not they were entirely wrong after the fact, you know. But they keep on getting booked, even though if you would put their batting average below their name, you know, like Jim Cramer, 4-37, right? Like things like that. Now I'm not going to get Jim Cramer on the show.
Booyah to you. Oh, you lost it.
Yeah. Bye. Yeah, I think that this is an interesting discussion. I wanted to also just kind of, since I know you got to go relatively soon. So the name of the show is Future Proof. We just kind of talked about this. And, you know, as such, we talked to a lot of people tasked with getting the future right. And a lot of authors where if the data changes, you know, they can start to talk about something else and they can say the data was wrong and here's why. But, you know, is it hard to make the proper predictions when you're at a company like OpenX that by its nature has some inherent biases like any company does?
Yeah, we sit in a really interesting spot. We're kind of like we're nonpartisan. We're the nonpartisan purple state player in the ad tech ecosystem, which means we don't really care where the money goes. Because we're the technology that sits behind that enables whether it's a CTV, a mobile device, whether you're on the New York Times or the Washington Post, whether you're on, you know, watching your favorite videos that are streaming of your favorite comedy routine. We are the inherent technology, one of the key players that makes it happen. So our goal much more that we lean in a lot more on through this research and through other things that we see in our ecosystem. You know, we do about a trillion transactions every month that we see across our exchange. So we're able to get an enormous amount of data and insights into how consumers are engaging with content, what works and what doesn't. Our goal is to then take that back to the marketers and help them understand, here's how you make sure that your spending is actually making sure that thriving open web continues to grow, that you reach consumers where they are and where they see fit. So that's why we do partnered research with research firms, not SurveyMonkey research. Nothing against SurveyMonkey. But
they're on the show next week.
Okay, well.
Now they're not.
They're gone. Jim Cramer and SurveyMonkey gone in 2 minutes. Wow. So I think that is really key for us, is to really understand fundamentally what's happening and let the whole ecosystem raise up.
It actually kind of brings me to an interesting follow-up I hadn't really thought of. You know, we talk about the Facebooks and the Googles of the world sitting on all this data, and obviously, to some extent, we can include OpenX in that discussion, right? Does that become, you know, a challenge to somebody who's trying to innovate in the future if they're not sitting on a wealth of data, and there are all of these players that have access to, you know, swaths of, swaths, is that a word? Swaths? Swathe? Whatever.
Swaths
of data?
I'll take that.
I feel like that's a new heavy metal band, Swaths of Data, playing at Bowery Ballroom. If you think about the swaths of data that bigger players are sitting on, does that become difficult for any new player to ever enter and to make bold predictions because they don't have, they're not sitting on what, you know, the larger players might be sitting on?
Look, we've been saying for years that data is the new currency of business, right? So that's nothing new. What is new is the moat these companies are building around their businesses with the data that they have. So, you know, we in our industry call them walled gardens. That's another way to think about them, Google and Facebook, where they control everything that happens in their walled garden. Nobody can get in. Nobody can see what's happening in there. They're completely locked out from transparency of that the open web has, where it's much more fluid of what's happening in that space. So if data is becoming a barrier to entry, which is actually probably kind of a good thing, because there are hundreds and hundreds of companies in this ecosystem already. The barrier to entry used to be very low. You could have four people with a server in their basement, and they'd be up and running 15 years ago. Now, you know, for example, in our space, we're a fully cloud-based company. It was a $125 million transition to move that level in a trillion transaction type ecosystem into the cloud to have that speed at which it needs to process all the data that we're thinking about. So you have, you know, more data, you have the ability to process it, it's becoming harder. So there are barriers to entry to get in. I think net-net, that's probably a good thing that we have fewer, better companies than, you know, hundreds of smaller players.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that more money, more problems. But I think when it comes to more data, you have definitely less problems just because if you can do the right things to actually parse that data and make sense of it, you've got a pretty significant advantage.
Yep. I love the living color reference.
Yeah. Benedict, I look forward to seeing you in Doctor Strange 2 shortly.
Should be great.
Yeah. But in all seriousness, Dallas, thanks so much for making the time. I know you've got to go, but this has been a fascinating conversation.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you guys so much for being with us today for our guest from California, not Dallas Howard, as I said in the intro that we cut, but Dallas Lawrence. If you enjoyed this conversation and you're not a subscriber yet, I forgive you, provided we change that over the next 10 seconds or so. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Every little bit has helped, and thanks so much for all of you who've come aboard over the last few weeks. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.